Right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our program Dr. Adam Gaffney, Research Fellow in Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Gaffney's recent article in Jacobin Magazine titled From Exchange to Egalite anticipated the Supreme Court decision in the King versus Burwell case that was handed down last week, upholding the legality of the Obamacare program to offer federal as well as state-based health insurance subsidies. Dr. Gaffney, thanks so much for making time for us and this really important discussion. And as you noted in your article, that the Supreme Court case was really not the end of the argument here. There's a lot more to do with the goal of achieving universal health care in the United States. So appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott. Happy to be here.
I wonder, as we begin our conversation, review for us what was at stake in the King versus Burwell case, where the Supreme Court, their ruling, supported the Affordable Care Act's continued health care insurance subsidies to those citizens enrolled in the federal exchange as well as the state.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a lot at stake, I would say. So, you know, the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010 was designed to reduce uninsurance, to make access more affordable. And it did that a couple of ways. You know, one of the ways was the expansion of Medicaid to everyone making up to 133% of poverty, and that was one way. But one of the second ways that it was intended to expand access was by first off mandating the purchase of health insurance for those who didn't get it from the government or through a job. And two, because it doesn't really make sense to mandate the purchase of insurance for people who can't afford it, the law also provided for subsidies, which could be fairly generous depending upon income, to purchase health insurance in these exchanges that you mentioned. There were to be state exchanges, but for those states that did not choose, for whatever reason, to set up their own exchange, there was a federal website exchange as well, healthcare.gov. People in those states could purchase health insurance from the federal exchange. And, you know, I think the legal kind of aspects at this point, now that it's been decided, are a little less interesting. Long story short, there was, in one provision of the law, a clause referring to subsidies only being available on exchanges, quote, established by the state. And the conservative sort of interpretation of that was that meant that only states that ran their own exchange would be allowed to offer subsidies. And that was something that, you know, the people who were around when the law was being drafted generally agree that was not at all the intention of the law. The law was intended to make, you know, subsidies available throughout the country. But long story short, that was the crux of the issue legally. And putting that aside, you know, what did it mean? What does this mean more in terms of what's happening on the ground? A lot, because 34 states were, in fact, relying on the federal marketplace. In those 34 states, more than 6 million people were using subsidies. So had the Supreme Court decided in favor of the plaintiffs, 6 million people very quickly could have lost subsidies. Health insurance for those people would have been unaffordable. You know, an estimated 8 million people, because all premiums would go up across the board, an estimated 8 million people or so would become uninsured. And when you lose, when you have 8 million people losing insurance suddenly, you know, you're talking about lives being lost. Some estimates range from 8 to 9,800 deaths a year potentially being lost from that sudden increase in uninsurance. So that was what was at stake. And so a lot was at stake. And I think the Supreme Court, I'm happy the way that they decided the case.
Dr. Gaffney, now that the Supreme Court has upheld the legality of the current structure of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, I wondered if you'd review for us both the strengths and inadequacies of the Affordable Care Act and the fact that certainly many millions of people in the United States will remain uninsured when the Obamacare program is fully implemented.
Absolutely. So, Yeah, so in terms of what is it doing that's helping people, we can start with that. So it's certainly reducing the number of the uninsured, in particular through the expansion of Medicaid. And so I think that that is certainly helping people. And I think the fact that some states are choosing not to expand Medicaid really is awful. It's a travesty. It's unforgivable and for me because, you know, that Medicaid expansion is being funded 100% by the government, the federal government now, and 90% by the federal government thereafter. So it's really almost a freebie for these states. So that's one way it's helping through the expansion of Medicaid. Certainly getting rid of, discrimination by insurance companies based on pre-existing conditions is a no-brainer and one that's very popular. So I think those two things are certainly helpful, and I think that anyone who has moved from being uninsured to being insured over the last few years as a result of the provisions of the ACA are probably to some extent happy. So, uninsurance is going down, and that's a good thing. So let's get to the negatives or to the shortcomings, rather, because many of the shortcomings are problems that we would have been dealing with even if the law had never been passed. So shortcoming number one, I would say, is that we're not talking about universal health care. And that word gets used loosely sometimes, but to my mind, and I think to most people's minds, universal health care means 100%. 100% of the country is covered. And that's not the case with the Affordable Care Act now, and it's not going to be the case in 10 years from now. About 27 million people are estimated to remain uninsured going forward, even with the act, the law in full effect. And only a minority of that can be blamed on the states who are not expanding Medicaid. And then, if I can have another moment, I'll talk about a second. There's a lot to say here, but I'll kind of focus on two things for starters. The second issue, which I think has been getting a lot of press in the last couple of years, and a lot of awareness about this issue has been raised. The problem of what people refer to as underinsurance, and this can be kind of construed broadly as having insurance, but not really necessarily being able to afford to get sick. And so we see this with this, this is an ongoing trend. It's been going on even before the Affordable Care Act came about, but it's not fixed by the Affordable Care Act. And that's the phenomenon of rising co-payments, doctor's visits or medicines, rising deductibles, you know, the amount of money you have to pay before you your insurance kicks in for medical bills, for hospitalizations, for anything really, something called coinsurance, which is a percentage of bills that you pay. So 20% coinsurance, you pay 20% of the bill, and the insurance company pays the rest. And these are concepts that if you're fortunate enough not to have to use your insurance in a major way, you'll be completely unfamiliar with, and you'll only become familiar if you get sick. And so the reality is that we've been moving towards greater underinsurance over the last 10 years. North of 30 million people are considered underinsured currently. The plans that you buy on the exchange, the same plans that were sort of saved by the King versus Burwell, have very high out-of-pocket expenditures, and that depends upon your income. There's subsidies for people with lower income, but for some people, out-of-pocket expenditures, this is after your premium, can be as high as $13,000, capped out at $13,000 a year, more than $13,000 a year for a family. And that would be a lot of money, for someone for a middle-class family. So we are not really talking about universal health care at this stage.
No, that's certainly true. And $13,000 out of pocket for many families is a deal breaker. It's just not going to work. It doesn't work within the budgets of families who are working on low-wage jobs, have both parents working in a family many hours or several jobs. It's a travesty to think that Obamacare is the end of the story. We're speaking with Dr. Adam Gaffney, research fellow in pulmonary and critical care medicine at both Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. We're talking about the Supreme Court case and their decision in the King versus Burwell case that came out in favor of upholding the current structure of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Gaffney, I wonder if you discuss for us for-profit medicine in the United States in contrast to most other nations in the industrialized world, where the United States remains really the only developed country not to have universal health care and have eliminated these for-profit insurance companies that certainly are a major cause of the skyrocketing prices of health care in this country.
Yes. I mean, I think they're certainly not helping. You know, one of the big things that there's not a lot of awareness about when it comes to the for-profit insurers that you're mentioning is how inefficient they are. You know, there's a general kind of notion that public programs are inefficient and private programs are more efficient, and that may be the case for in certain arenas, but it's not the case for healthcare. For a number of reasons, single unitary programs like Medicare are actually much leaner and more efficient than are the private insurers. So the typically quoted figure for the amount of total Medicare expenditures that go to overhead, administration, that sort of thing, is 2%, whereas the private insurers are generally quoted at above 10% for things like administration, overhead, and profits. So they're not efficient at all, and there's a lot of potential savings there. Then that's one issue. The second is just have on a more global scale, having our whole healthcare system divvied up and fragmented into these different insurers, and having each hospital and physician having to deal with multiple insurers, hospitals having to itemize bills for patients and every service they get or every, cotton swab and so forth, is incredibly wasteful. And so we have an extremely inefficient healthcare system as a result of that privatized, fragmented foundation. I agree with you that it's really not feasible for the long term.
Dr. Gaffney, given that the Supreme Court case is in the rearview mirror here with the structure of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act intact, how do you see the country moving towards a more universal health care system? We have the example of Canada, where one province, Saskatchewan, implemented a single-payer system there. It worked quite well, and it was emulated by the federal government eventually, and that's why Canada today has a single-payer system. Vermont has voted to implement a single-payer system, although that plan has hit some bumps in the road with its financing plan having been thrown overboard by the Democratic governor of that state. But there are grassroots efforts now to restore some kind of viable finance plan. But from your viewpoint, do you think a state-by-state approach to moving towards a single-payer system versus a federal Medicare for All system, what do you think would be the best approach, best strategy for people who want such a plan to move in the direction of?
Right. You know, and it's a important question. It gets to the question of strategy, because we can talk about the wonders of true universal single-payer healthcare system all day long, but how do we actually get there? That's really the crucial question. And I don't know. I mean, people have very strong feelings on this. What I would say is that there certainly are significant roadblocks to a state-based approach. There are certain federal programs that will be difficult to incorporate into a state system, and people have kind of debated this for a while. My personal feeling is that no one can really predict the future here, and the most likely road to success, the way I see it, is a two-pronged approach. I'd like to see some states move in the direction of single-payer systems or something similar to a single-payer system. I think that could add fuel to the fire for the national stage. I don't think we can abandon, the national campaign either. And the politics are not in place right now for this to happen, of course, at the federal level. But we'll see. You know, I think the discourse has been changing around things like inequality. There seems to be a bit of a progressive swell going on right now. So I see it as a two-pronged campaign. It would be wonderful to have some successes at the state level. I think we need to continue on the national level. And I think they can sort of work in tandem and kind of feed each other.
Dr. Gaffney, you work at some prominent hospitals, and I'm wondering what kind of attitude your colleagues in the medical profession have towards Obamacare and its apparent, its obvious inadequacies here. I mean, given the fact that 27 million people will remain uninsured under the Affordable Care Act, it seems obvious that we have to fix this current system and move toward a universal healthcare system. But I'm wondering what the attitude of the people that you work with every day at the hospitals where you attend patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that opinions are pretty diverse, as they are, you know, in America at large. My own sort of interactions are fairly anecdotal. I could speak to that, but I could also just speak to some of the polling that's been done nationwide of physicians specifically. And, you know, although I think physicians often have a bit of a reputation for being fairly conservative, and that certainly was the case in some earlier healthcare reform battles, you know, in the 1950s, for instance, when the American Medical Association really led the charge against Harry Truman's efforts at a national health program. Things have changed in that arena. You know, many polls, I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but show, you know, a majority or near majority support among physicians for a single payer system. And it probably differs by specialty and that sort of thing. So I think that there's much more openness on the side of physicians than many people would expect, just given the history and maybe the reputation. So I'm hopeful on the physician end, to be honest with you. I think the bigger barriers to overcome are going to be more on the level of the major corporate industrial entities that have a stake in how this, you know, what happens with healthcare in America. So certainly the insurance companies, the health insurance companies, and I think the pharmaceutical companies as well, we can expect would not go along very nicely with this this sort of program.
We're speaking here on Counterpoint with Dr. Adam Gaffney, Research Fellow in Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Gaffney, when you look at the grassroots movement that you believe would be necessary to move the politics of the country in the direction of a single-payer healthcare system, what do you see the seeds of that anywhere around the country that gives you hope that something like that could develop in the near future? And conversely, as you said, you have the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical corporations that wield enormous influence in the halls of Congress, who would obviously stand to lose in any shift towards a nonprofit single-payer system.
Right. Absolutely. And to answer the first part of your question, I do see the seeds of something, things moving in a progressive direction. I'm not a political analyst, but what I would say is that, I think since Occupy, the language of inequality, the 99% has been prominent. I think that, we see even among the Democratic candidates, a bit of attack to the left. You have, Bernie Sanders, obviously, who's trailing Hillary Clinton, but is the second, in second place in the Democratic primary, speaking very forcefully about economic inequality, but also specifically about a single payer system. He is, in fact, an advocate for a single payer system at the federal national level. So I think that you see, I do see some evidence of rising outrage at inequality. And I think that to the extent that that our healthcare system actually plays into inequality instead of actually rolling it back, which is, in my opinion, what a good healthcare system should do, I think that these two campaigns could be intertwined. At the same time, you're going to have a dynamic that I think there's going to be, people unhappy with their healthcare plans. I think there's going to be a lot of disappointment with, again, the things that I talked about, the deductibles and the co-payments and high out-of-pocket expenditures. And so I think some of that discontent is going to be channeled into a demand for change. Right. So I think that, sort of an answer to the first part of your question. The second part of the question, which is, in regard to how do we deal with the opposition that we're expecting to see, I don't have an easy answer for that. I think that there has been historically political movements that have overcome major challenges and powerful interests. So I think we can draw some inspiration from that past. I don't think it's going to be anything particularly different that we're going to do to overcome this other than what's been done in the past, which is popular mobilization, awareness, and just an overall potent mobilization.
One thing I worry about, and maybe get your thought on this, is that when people become aware of the limitations and inadequacies of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, they may blame it on government health care, which Obamacare decidedly is not, because it preserves the prominent role for the private health insurance industry, and is by no means government health care like we have in Canada or Great Britain or any of the other industrialized nations that have single payer. But the average person in this country may be influenced by the propaganda that's been launched about Obamacare, saying this is a government takeover of health care. Clearly, that's an attempt to mislead folks. But I'm wondering if people will understand there's a third way between a laissez-faire marketplace insurance system, as we've had for many, many decades, and the Obamacare system, and then, of course, this third alternative that most of the other nations in the world have adopted.
I think you're speaking to a critical issue, and I think this is an issue where many of us can get involved. There is certainly a danger of our current discourse being used in the way you said, that discontent at particular health plans, narrow networks, high deductibles, what have you, can be sort of transformed into, well, this is the problem with government-run healthcare, exactly as you said. Even in Vermont, for instance, just to go back to the Vermont example, you had spoken about the campaign for single payer there and how it suffered reverse. And one thing that several people have pointed out is that one thing that partially discredited the single-payer movement there, or at least the enthusiasm, rather than the movement, more the enthusiasm of the single-payer, was how dysfunctional the rollout of the marketplace was, the state marketplace.
Right.
There. So you're right. And so I think that winning this is going to require a lot of work in the battleground of ideas and of political discourse, because exactly as you said, a lot of this discontent could be wielded against any public system, even though it's not, as you said, what we actually have.
Well, Dr. Gaffney, as we say goodnight here, would you like to leave our listeners with any websites and organizational contacts that would help them learn more about the effort for single payer across the country?
Absolutely. So I'll just mention an organization I'm a part of, Physicians for a National Health Program, or PNHP.org, more geared to health professionals, but it has a wonderful wealth of resources. I'll mention my own website as well, just because it has links to some of the articles and contact information if anyone has any questions. And that's the progressivephysician.org. I think that there's a lot of work to be done ahead, but I am hopeful.
Well, I'm hopeful because you're out there, talking about this, writing about it, and an advocate for a single payer where we need it most within the medical profession. So thanks for all you're working on every day, Dr. Gaffney, and certainly appreciate your time discussing with us tonight on the program.
It was really nice to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Take care. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
That's Dr. Adam Gaffney, research fellow in pulmonary and critical care medicine at both Harvard Medical School and the Massachusetts General Hospital.